Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on what the hell's going on here when we come back. You know, when people call the law school, they ask oftentimes how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, keep in mind that most of the topics that you hear on this program, I teach in detail in one of my classes, one of 8 schools here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great that codified the common law in 872 AD into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 of those statutes or principles of law have been incorporated into our federal constitution and into our Bill of Rights. The common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai, and that was recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. And it includes negligence and insurance and taxes, such as income tax and property tax and Social Security. These IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of the tithing laws of the Scripture, and they work a theft on all of us who participate in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and Social Security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. It is true that we owe this income tax and Social Security tax because we have contracted into it. Has it ever occurred to us that maybe we ought to contract out of it? Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org to send us an email, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, last time we were talking about how wealthy or how rich you were. If you had $2,200, you're in the top 50% of wealth holders in the world. And that came from an article, and I didn't give you this yesterday, but I'm going to give it to you today. It came from an article, and it's titled articles.moneycentral.msn.com. So again, that's articles.moneycentral.msn.com. All right, that was one. Then I gave you another report on the real U.S. shortfall, $4.6 trillion in the red, just so that you can get one for yourself. It comes from World Net Daily, WND. And you can get that at www.wnd.com. Easy enough to get it. It's www.wnd.com for that report. Now, there's a newsletter that's put out by A.V. Krebs. A.V. Krebs, called the Calamity Howler. It's a liberal newsletter. There's not too many of those. Most of these newsletters that I subscribe to are conservative newsletters, but this one is a liberal, and he's a pretty good guy. I kind of like him. And he puts on some kind of a balancing act, you know, to the other side of gloom and doom. You know, well, this is gloom and doom from the Democrats instead of gloom and doom from the Republicans. Or gloom and doom, you know, from this right-wing radical versus gloom and doom from this left-wing, what do they call it, left-wing progressive or something like that. If you'd like to get a copy of the Calamity Howler, if you'd like to subscribe, it's pretty inexpensive. Just send an email to avkrebs@comcast.net. So to receive, all you have to do is send your name and address to avkrebs@comcast.net. It's easy enough. I'm going to give you a couple of stories here out of the Calamity Howler. Now, the price on the Calamity Howler is governed by what do you want to give. It's a donation-type program. And, you know, if you want me to price it for you, I'll tell you what I think it's worth. And I think it's worth $10 a month, $120 a year, and it comes out weekly, about 52 issues a year. And I would price it right in there with the International Forecaster or with the Privateer, Money Changer. A little different perspective. I'm going to give you a couple articles over here and ask the question, what the hell is going on? No. Down here at the bottom of the pecking order, we got to ask, what in the hell is going on here? The world's going nuts. And A.V. Krebs gives us some good reports that come out of that. And so he's not going to, you know, he's not going to send you a bill, and he's not going to cut you off if you don't send him any money. But I would encourage you to send him $10 a month if you like the newsletter. If you don't like it, just send him an email and tell him, hey, cancel. You may be offended if you're a right winger. He says that sometimes an intended epithet can be turned to good advantage in the sole surviving issue of the Decatur Texas Times. One finds the way populists not only accepted the label Calamity Howler, but insisted that they had ample reason to howl and would continue to howl until their objectives had been attained. It's called The Populist Mind, edited by Norman Pollack, P-O-L-L-A-C-K. Remember, the editor publisher is A.V. Krebs, and you can email A.V. Krebs. I don't know what his name is. All I know is it's A.V. Krebs at comcast.net. Let's take a look here at a couple of stories that he put in here. Palestine peace, not apartheid. Carter's apartheid charges ring true. I read this article and I said, well, I didn't know this before, so let me share it with you. Over in Israel, Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, you have this controversy, and you and I, you know, we read the news and we see Katie come on, and she reports on the latest killings and what's going on over here between the Jews and the Palestinians, and of course we have a view of that. You know, if you're an American Christian, And you're pro-Israeli or Israel, then that's your mindset and worldview. If you're a Muslim, and you don't have to be from Palestine, you can be a Muslim from Indonesia, and you are going to see the Palestine-Israel conflict in your mindset or in your view. And of course, those of us that are neither one of these camps, we kind of look over here at both of these warring camps and shake our heads like, what the hell's going on here? Well, Jimmy Carter just wrote a book here the other day, and it's been in the news, and he likened the Israelis' treatment of the Palestinians to the South Africans, that is, the white South Africans' treatment of the blacks in South Africa in a program called apartheid, which everybody is opposed to, you know. Everybody says this apartheid's bad. I'm not here to tell you it's good or bad or right or wrong. I'm just here as a reporter to report to you a little piece of the puzzle here. Former President Jimmy Carter has come under sustained attack for having dared to use the term apartheid to describe Israel's policies in the West Bank. However, not one of Carter's critics has offered a convincing argument to justify the vehemence of the outcry, much less to refute his central claim that Israel bestows rights on Jewish residents settling illegally on Palestinian land, while denying the same rights to the indigenous Palestinians. Little wonder, for they are attempting to defy reality itself. Now, Israel maintains two separate road networks in the West Bank. One road network is for the exclusive use of Jewish settlers. The other one for Palestinian natives. Isn't that called apartheid? All right, now let me ask you this. Here in America, when we had two separate restaurants, one restaurant for blacks and one restaurant for whites, what did we call that in Alabama? And with that, I'll rest my case and let you decide. Now, Palestinians are not allowed to drive their own cars in much of the West Bank. Their public transportation is frequently interrupted or blocked altogether by a grid of Israeli army checkpoints. But Jewish settlers come and go freely in their own cars, without even pausing at the roadblocks that hold up the natives. Is that not apartheid? A system of closures and curfews has strangled the Palestinian economy in the West Bank, but none of its provisions apply to the Jewish settlements there. Well, now, isn't that apartheid? Whole sectors of the West Bank, classified as closed military areas by the Israeli army, are off limits to Palestinians, including Palestinians who own land there. But foreigners to whom Israel's law of return applies, and that is anyone who is Jewish from anywhere in the world, can access them without any hindrance whatsoever. Don't we call that apartheid? Persons of Palestinian origin are routinely barred from entering or residing in the West Bank. But Israel and non-Israeli Jews can come and go, and they can even live on occupied Palestinian territory. Now, isn't that apartheid? Israel maintains two sets of rules and regulations in the West Bank. One set of rules for the Jews, and one set of Jews for the non-Jews. The only thing wrong with using the word apartheid to describe such a repugnant system is that the South African version of institutionalized discrimination was never as elaborate as its Israeli counterpart, nor did the South Africans have such a vocal chorus of defenders among otherwise liberal Americans. Isn't that apartheid? The glaring error in Carter's book, however, is his insistence that the term apartheid does not apply to Israel itself, where he says Jewish and non-Jewish citizens are given the same treatment under the law. But that is simply not true. Israeli law affords differences in privileges for Jewish and non-Jewish citizens of the State of Israel in matters of access to land, family unification, and the acquisition of citizenship. Israel's amended nationality law, for example, prevents Palestinian citizens of Israel who are married to Palestinians from the occupied territories from living together in Israel. A similar law passed at the peak of apartheid in South Africa was overturned by that country's Supreme Court as a violation of the right to a family. Israel's High Court upheld the Israeli law just last year. Isn't that apartheid? Now, Israel loudly proclaims itself to be the state of the Jewish people, rather than the state of its actual citizens, one-fifth of whom are Palestinian Arabs. In fact, in registering citizens, the Israeli Ministry of the Interior assigns them a whole range of nationalities other than Israeli. In the official registry, the nationality line for a Jewish citizen of Israel reads Jew. For a Palestinian citizen, the same line reads Arab. When this glaring inequity was protested all the way to Israel's High Court, the justices upheld it. There is no Israeli nation separate from the Jewish people. Obviously, this leaves non-Jewish citizens of Israel in, at best, a somewhat ambiguous situation. Little wonder, then, that a solid majority of Israeli Jews regard their fellow Arab citizens as what they call a demographic threat, which many, including the Deputy Prime Minister, would like to see eliminated altogether. What do you call that? If it isn't racism, isn't that apartheid? Now, many of the very individuals and institutions that are so vociferously denouncing President Jimmy Carter would not for one moment tolerate such a glaring injustice here in the United States. So why do they condone the naked racism and apartheid Israeli practices? Why do they heap criticism on our former president for speaking his conscience about such a truly unconscionable system of ethnic segregation? Perhaps it's because they themselves are all too aware that they are defending the indefensible, because they are all too aware that the emperor that they keep trying to cover up really has no clothes. And there is a limit to how long such a cover-up can go on. And the main lesson of Carter's book is that we have finally reached that limit. That, my friends, we call apartheid. And that's what goes on over in our friendly nation of Israel. The same good people who maintain Mossad spies over here in the United States spying on us. I used to wonder about that. You know, if I was your friend, you know, I'm your buddy, and you and I are good buddies, and we are working buddies and so on. But I come over to your house and I peek through your bedroom window. I'm a peeping Tom. What would you think of me? Now, I would expect, you know, some enemy to come over and peek through my bedroom window. You might expect some guy that you don't know or some guy that doesn't like you, you know, to come over and peek through your bedroom window. But would you be expecting your friends to do that? That's kind of the way I see spying. I would expect the Russians and the Chinese to be spying on us. But what about your friends? When you find out that the English, the French, the Germans, and the Israelis are spying on you, what do you think about that? And I haven't heard much about the English or the French or the Germans spying on us, or at least if they are, they haven't got caught. But the Israelis now have been caught spying on American secrets or stealing American secrets at least 3 times in the last 10 years that I can remember. 3 times in the last 10 years. Boys and girls with friends like that, who needs enemies? Nagasaki. Now here was a neat article, came out of the Calamity Howler, A.V. Krebs, remember that name, A.V. Krebs, all one word, at Comcast.net. And this is the 12/22/06 edition, came out last Friday. It says, the Nagasaki bombing is labeled a crime. Can you believe that? Bombing Nagasaki labeled a crime. Now, who would label such a thing a crime? Well, listen to this. One of Japan's most senior politicians has said that the United States atomic bombing of Nagasaki in 1945 was impermissible from a humanitarian point of view. This guy's name is Shoichi Nagagawa. Nakagawa, the policy chief of the governing party. He said that the use of atomic weapons was a crime. Mr. Nakagawa, has attracted controversy recently, calling for a debate on whether Japan should have nuclear arms. He raised the possibility that North Koreans might try to attack Japan with their own nuclear weapons. Speaking in Nagasaki over the weekend, Mr. Nagagawa, a right-winger, said that atomic bombings were a crime. The American decision to drop the atomic bomb was truly impermissible on humanitarian grounds, he said. And he repeated the comments on Monday, telling Reuters news agency, by dropping two atomic bombs, many people, including ordinary citizens, were killed. I believe that such an act can be called a crime. After the nuclear attacks in 1945, the Japanese wartime government condemned the bombings as crimes against international law. But later on, the authorities gave up any idea of pursuing the issue of criminality. Today, the phrase the government more often uses to describe the attack is called regrettable. Mr. Nagagawa appears to be going further, saying that they were impermissible on humanitarian grounds. I looked at that article and I said, well, excuse me, partner, excuse me, but that may be true. But you sure as hell ain't the guy that ought to be telling us that it's a crime. It might be that if you were an Indian sitting over in Calcutta, you might look at that event and say, boy, those Americans are real criminals, dropping atomic bombs on women and children in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But I sure as hell resent a Jap telling me that. And I'll tell you why. The Japanese attacked China in the 1930s. And they were bombing and killing. They didn't have nuclear weapons, but they were bombing and killing women and children by the tens of thousands. Which is why the Chinese to this day don't have a whole lot of empathy for the Japs. To this day. And you know, bygones are bygones, and I'd say, you know, World War II was a regrettable chapter in history, and we Americans were the instigators of it. I don't deny that. But hey, listen, you know, after you attacked us at Pearl Harbor, and after you attacked the Chinese, and after Corregidor and Bataan, and you took our prisoners and you killed them in ditches along the roadsides, you sure as hell aren't the moral judges to be condemning us. Now, that's my opinion. Again, this comes from A.V. Krebs. You know, A.V. Krebs. @comcast.net. I don't mind being called a criminal by some neutral guy, but the protagonist over there, I kind of take offense at that. There's another couple of neat articles in here. Our new defense secretary, A.V. Krebs, makes a report here in the Calamity Howler on the new defense secretary, Robert Gates. Nice guy that he is. You know, we want to give... He was the CIA chief, I believe it was. I kind of forget now. I'm getting old, you know, and forgetful here. But Gates was around during the Reagan years or the Bush years or something like that. You know, Bush 1. So Gates has been in government for a long time. He's probably a pretty nice guy. He probably got a wife and kids and a lawn to mow and dogs to feed just like you and me. But... listen to this. Our new defense secretary's business ties raise concerns. In the 14 years since Gates left government, former CIA director Robert M. Gates has jetted cross-country to advise 10 different companies assessing issues as varied as Saudi oil drilling, mutual fund performance, and restaurant sales at Romano's Macaroni Grill. And I first sought him out because I considered him to be of exceptional good judgment and intelligence, said Rodney B. Mitchell. He's the president of the Mitchell Group. That's a Houston investment firm that uses Gates as a senior advisor. Impressed with Gates' recent performance as president of Texas A&M University, Mitchell believed Gates offered pragmatism to a firm that aims to exploit the rapidly changing dynamics of world energy markets. But as Gates awaits Senate confirmation as President Bush's Secretary of Defense, ethics watchdogs worry about the revolving door between government and private business that allowed Gates to align himself with defense contractors. I'm going to underline that. Gates, now the Secretary of Defense. has aligned himself in the past with defense contractors. Hang on a second. Let's see if we can do something about this step. Let's try that. So I underline defense contractors, investment houses. Would that include Goldman Sachs, who happens to have their former CEO now running our treasury, and a global drilling company involved with Vice President Dick Cheney, the former employer of the Halliburton Company. He was a former employee of Halliburton. Dick Cheney was. He was the CEO. Now listen, here's this new guy, Gates. And he's in bed with defense contractors, investment houses, and Dick Cheney and Halliburton. And excuse me, folks, while I chuckle here a little bit. But does this sound like arm's length to you? I mean, here in America, we used to have a process in which, we used to put the best face forward. We used to try to show people, hey, listen, just because I'm the Secretary of the Treasury, don't think for a moment that I'm going to favor Goldman Sachs or somebody else over here because I used to work for them, or because I've got a golden parachute from them or something else. We used to put those assets into a trust, or a blind trust, they called it, so that the actions that I take as the Secretary of the Treasury aren't going to impact or benefit me personally or financially or benefit my family and friends, also known as nepotism. But now, in this Republican administration, they don't even cover it up or hide it. I mean, they just take it right out there and flaunt it. Kind of like old Betty said, you know, if you got it, flaunt it. That's one of Flo's girls, you know, Betty. Now, these whores in Washington today, you know, they've got it and they're flaunting it. How do you like it? Just thought I'd share that with you. Companies with which Gates has been affiliated have secured hefty no-bid Pentagon contracts. Let me underline hefty no-bid Pentagon contracts. Now, our last Secretary of Defense, remember Donald Rumsfeld, he let out these no-bid contracts to Halliburton to go over to Iraq to provide services over there, and we just pay the bill. It's kind of like giving them a blank check, you know. You just sign the check, hand it out, and say, just fill in the amount. We don't need any competitive bids on this job. We don't. Now, boys and girls, there isn't any of us that has his head on straight that would call a general contractor and say, hey, remodel my kitchen. Here's a check. Just fill in the amount when you're done. Well, what in the hell is this no-bid contract? And who in the hell is this Gates guy coming in here with the same buddies, you know, Dick Cheney, and with the same commercial ties to oil companies, Halliburton, and... Hey, isn't that the same thing that we just got rid of? Well, then doesn't that tell you then you can expect more of the same? And you have to wonder if these companies will continue to get around bidding requirements once Gates is the new Secretary of Defense, asked Alex Knott, political director of the Center for Public Integrity, a Washington-based watchdog group. Common Cause, another nonprofit watchdog, believes Gates should take steps now to insulate himself, including placing his stock holdings, some of which he acquired in return for board service, in a blind trust to avoid conflicts of interest with companies seeking federal work. The Bush administration has been dogged by allegations that past corporate affiliations of administration officials led to favored treatment in federal contract awards. Much of the criticism is focused on Cheney's relationship with Houston Oil Services giant Halliburton, which has secured $1.5 billion in no-bid contracts for reconstruction in Iraq. Cheney was the firm's chief executive and retained Halliburton stock when he became vice president. Do you suppose that maybe Dick Cheney, Vice President of the United States, who holds Halliburton stock, if he were sitting with President Bush in a meeting someplace, do you think maybe he might recommend Halliburton as the contractor over, say, Bechtel or Atkinson or some other contracting company? because he owns stock in Halliburton. I mean, boys and girls, you know, I'm just Joe Sixpack over here, but let me tell you, if I had Halliburton stock, I would be recommending Halliburton. If I had Bechtel stock, I would be recommending Bechtel. I don't see that any of these public officials would be doing anything different. And I don't think that that's fair. I think that that's akin to bribery. And I think God told us not to take gifts, because gifts pervert the eyes of the wise. Not that I see much wisdom in Washington to start with, but I just thought I'd point that out. The Bush administration has been dogged by allegations that past corporate affiliations of administration officials led to favored treatment in federal contract awards. Let me point this out. It's common knowledge that the Food and Drug Administration will give a favorable report on a drug that is submitted by Pfizer. And then the officials in the FDA, when they finish their term at the FDA, will then go over to Pfizer and get a lucrative private industry job with Pfizer after they have approved this multi-billion-dollar drug. Now, don't you think that's more akin to insider trading? I mean, we get real upset at Martha Stewart for insider trading, and we put her in jail. And then we appoint guys like Bill Gates and Dick Cheney and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld to positions of authority and power in our government so that they can benefit these private corporations and feather their own nest? Then that's not insider trading. I mean, what the hell's going on here, kids? Have we taken leave of our senses? All right, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about The Law School or The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that are endorsed or recommended by us are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may or may not be endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, management, staff, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, and our phone number is 417-273-4967. And let me remind you that we're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative methods being used for the treatment and healing of cancer. I'm going to change that word to the botch of Egypt here. Let me write that in here. Before the American Medical Association comes down on me and wants to sue me over here, you know, for violating their copyright. Botch of Egypt. That's the generic name for cancer, which now affects about 50% of Americans. And then how to prevent degenerative diseases, abdominal fat, the use and application of essential oils, super nutritional foods containing more nutrients and fewer calories. The class also includes hands-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training so that you can do it at home, privately and personally, acupressure application and training so you can find the pressure points, and much, much more to contribute to your ongoing health. Class is going to be held February 5th through the 9th here in Isabella, Missouri. If you're interested, call my wife Jackie here at the law school, 417-273-4967. Remember, Jackie's a 28-year cancer survivor. It's a how-to rather than a what-to. And, you know, medical doctors keep it simple. And I contend you need to keep this thing of natural healing simple. So we will avoid five-syllable, double-jointed knee-action words like lysine, amino acids, enzymes, vitamins and minerals, and fatty acids, and get down to the nitty-gritty and tell you what you need to know. It's a how-to program. All right. With that out of the way, let me get back here to A.V. Krebs over here and the Common Cause. Remember these guys, Common Cause, another non-profit watchdog group? Well, the Bush administration's been dogged by these allegations of past corporate affiliations of administration officials. And the Senate Armed Services Committee required outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to divest himself of defense-related stocks to avoid conflicts. But it allowed him to keep holdings worth as much as $25 million in Gilead Sciences, a California company that developed a drug used to treat bird flu. And remember, it was this Rumsfeld over here that had the same conflict of interest when he was in government. He was the CEO of the Searle Drug Company. They're the people who developed this aspartame. Then when he got into government, he was instrumental in having that aspartame, which is a deadly poison killing tens of thousands of people every year, approved by the FDA. That's our outgoing Secretary of Defense. Gilead, for which Rumsfeld served as board chairman, has seen its stock prices soar with sales to the Pentagon and other government customers. Rumsfeld, who through the Pentagon has denied any conflict, reported $5 million in Gilead capital gains in 2005. Did you get that, boys and girls? Now, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, owns stock in this Gilead company, and in 2005 he made $5 million on it because this Gilead company is, their stock prices are soaring because of their sales to the war effort in Iraq, and guess what? The Secretary of Defense is a big stockholder. Now, does that make sense to you? Hell, it makes all the sense in the world. I mean, hell, if I was the Secretary of Defense and I had stock in Bechtel, I would be recommending Bechtel. I would be working my heart out for whatever company that I own stock in. And would that be a conflict of interest? Well, of course. Of course it would be. Would it be a fleecing of America? Of course it would be. Would it be theft? Of course. Would I do it? Absolutely. No doubt in my mind. You know, human beings are motivated by vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And Donald Rumsfeld and Bill Gates are motivated by the same five motivators, just like I am, just like you are, and everybody else. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Boys and girls, if I were being paid by A.V. Krebs to promote his newsletter, I would promote his newsletter for the money. Now, as it happens, Mr. Krebs doesn't pay me to review his newsletter. I do it and I take articles out of here because they're articles that I think that you need to know about, that you ought to hear about, somebody ought to tell you. And I think somebody ought to tell you about Bill Gates and somebody ought to tell you about Donald Rumsfeld. Now, we're not going to change the nominating process. We're not going to change anything here. I'm not advocating that you march on Washington or write a letter to George Bush. but you ought to tuck it away in your heart, and you ought to start thinking for yourself, now how does this benefit me? Do I really want to participate in this program? Maybe I ought to consider opting out. I mean, it's a choice you have to make. Maybe you ought to think about opting out of this program. In preparation for hearings that are set to begin next week, the Armed Services panel has asked Gates to complete a standard questionnaire about his corporate affiliations and stockholdings. Gates, in a 1994 opinion piece, compared the process of Senate confirmation to a root canal, warning prospective public officials to prepare for scrutiny of every aspect of their personal finances and corporate relationships. Financial disclosure forms filed in recent years with the Texas Ethics Commission show that Gates juggled various corporate relationships with his job as Texas A&M president. The university last year paid him $525,000 in salary, and he nearly doubled his income through outside directorships, Securities and Exchange Commission documents show. Gates' personal holdings have grown substantially since he left government. And when he had no more than $165,000 in savings and retirement accounts when he was in government, now he has $1.1 million in holdings with Fidelity Investments, as well as stock holdings in some of the companies where he has served as director. See, these guys, they work in government for a while, and then when they get out of government, then they go to work in private industry. They become lobbyists. And then, of course, they've got chits and they've got favors that are owed to them by members of Congress, and so they go over and they collect on those chits and favors. They vote this way or vote that way. That's what you just saw with this Jack Abramoff. You know, he's around here, he's a lobbyist, and he was paying bribes. And that's all campaign contributions are, is bribes. that's what the politician wants, is a campaign contribution so he can buy television time, so he can get you to vote for him and get reelected. I mean, that's the purpose behind it. Then he gets reelected, and he serves, 5, 10, 15 years, and then he leaves government, goes to work for these private companies like Searle and Donald Rumsfeld and government, and the FDA and Searle and Donald Rumsfeld and government, and Searle and the FDA and Donald Rumsfeld and government, and so on. And they got this revolving door, like Searle and Donald Rumsfeld and the FDA and Searle and Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, come on, kids. Can you get the drift? Bill Gates is just doing what Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and every other government official is doing. You got 535 of them in the Congress, all doing the same thing. They're all making money off of you. You're paying your taxes. God bless you, taxpayers. We need more of you. One more article in here that I wanted to cover. It was the Pinochet story. And it's toward the end of the paper here, so be patient with me here. Told you about the Nagasaki bombing. Told you about the Palestinian peace and apartheid story. And there's another story in here about Kissinger and the Pinochet regime. This guy, Pinochet. He was 92 years old. He just died here a couple of weeks ago down in Chile. Well, back in about 1970 or so, and I'll just tell you a little recollection here. Some of you kids probably weren't even born in 1970, but I'll give you a little background here on the rogue government, the United States of America. Back in the 70s, we were kind of anti-communist here in America. And we were real concerned about, the communists and the Russians and the Chinese making inroads here in America. And I don't know why we were concerned about Chile. I'd get more concerned about Cuba, but, just seems like to me a communist government 90 miles from Havana, Miami is more of a threat to us than a government 3,000 miles away in Chile. But for some reason, the people of Chile, dumb, stupid, ignorant peons that they are, voted in a guy by the name of Allende, who was a communist. Well, at least that's what we thought. Now, we Americans are the champions of democracy, aren't we? I mean, we're opposed to Hitler because he's a dictator, and we're the champions of democracy in Iraq because they were dominated by this Saddam Hussein guy who was a damn dictator, wasn't he? All right. So I got to ask, what the hell's going on here? The people of Chile, back in 1970, 71, 72, something like that, they vote in this communist in an election. Kind of like the Palestinians. You know, the other day they voted in Hamas. Remember? And then the Bush administration says, oh, that Hamas, or whatever the other gang is, I've forgotten. I can't keep track of all those gangs, but listen, if the people in Palestine want to vote in the Hamas gang or the ADL gang or some other gang, isn't that their business? Isn't that what democracy's all about? That's what I thought. I thought, you know, whatever party, whatever group, you know, wins, and that's the will of the people. And I'm not defending democracy now by any stretch of the imagination. Our founding fathers never had a civil word in their mouths for democracy. Not a one of them ever said anything constructive or intelligent about democracy as being a viable form of government for America. That's why they gave us a republic. But I just wanted to point out that, you know, we seem to be the champions of democracy around the world. Well, anyway, here they voted in this Allende government, these dumb peons down here in Chile. And so we Americans had to go down there and butt in, like we always do, and fix that for them. They made a mistake, and so we're going to fix it. And the guy that fixed it was Kissinger. So here's the story. As the world marked International Human Rights Day, one of the century's most notorious dictators, General Augusto Pinochet, died under house arrest in Chile at the age of 91. His 17-year reign left a deep scar on Chilean society. And yet Pinochet's legacy includes an ironic upside. It was Pinochet's regime and the United States' support for that regime which galvanized that modern-day international human rights movement. On September the 11th, 2001, as the airplanes hit the towers of the World Trade Center on our daily broadcast of Democracy Now!, we were looking at the connection between terrorism and September 11th, 1973, because it was on that day that the democratically elected government of Chilean President Salvador Allende was overthrown in a violent coup and the forces of Pinochet rose to power. The coup was supported by the United States government, and Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor and the United States Secretary of State, summed up the policy this way. Kissinger said, quote, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people." God, I got to underline that. Here's Henry Kissinger, and he says, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist because of the irresponsibility of its own people." Now that tells you Chileans down there, you're a bunch of irresponsible peons, and we know what's best for you. So sit down and shut up. Well, excuse me, troops, but isn't that what we're saying to the Iraqis? That you Iraqis over there are a bunch of ignorant ragheads and you don't know what's good for you, so we're going to go over there and we're going to do it for you. We're going to give you democracy and an income tax and gun control. That was a kicker. Saddam Hussein, I don't know how bad the guy was. Everybody tells me what a bad guy he was, but I don't think that Saddam Hussein ever killed nearly as many of you Iraqis as George Bush has accomplished. He sure as hell didn't do it in 4 years. And then on top of that, you didn't have an income tax over there in Iraq until we Americans got over there and showed you how to have a progressive democratic society. And then you didn't have gun control either, like we have in America with 25,000 gun laws on our books, in spite of our Second Amendment. Anyway, getting back here to Henry Kissinger. "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people." What the hell is going on here, troops? "The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves."
Did you get that? That's Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, our Secretary of State, 1973, he said, the issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves, so we're going to decide for you here in Washington, D.C. That's what we're doing over in Iraq, isn't it? That's what we want to do in North Korea, isn't it? That's what we're preparing to do in Iran, isn't it? That's what we did in Afghanistan. All right, now he goes on, as Pinochet seized power, first among the dead was the president himself, Allende, so they killed him. Isn't that what we're going to do to Saddam Hussein? We're going to kill him. Then there were the thousands rounded up. Among them was Victor Jara, the legendary Chilean folk singer. Jara was beaten, tortured, and then executed. His body was dumped on a Santiago street and found by his wife in the morgue. Ah, but they're just peons. Charles Horman was a U.S. journalist working in Chile. He, too, disappeared in those days following the coup. His body was found buried in a cement wall. His story was immortalized in the Academy Award-winning Constantine Costa Gavras film Missing. His widow, Joyce Horman, sued not only Pinochet for the death of her husband, but also Henry Kissinger and others at the U.S. State Department. Pinochet's reign of terrorism extended beyond Chile's borders. On September 21, 1976, the former foreign minister of Chile, Orlando Letelier, and his American colleague Ronnie Moffat died in a car bombing, not in Chile, but on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. Then there was Chile's current president, Michelle Bachelet. Her father was a general under Allende and opposed the coup. He was arrested and died of a heart attack in prison. Just a coincidence, I'm sure. She and her mother were detained and tortured at the notorious Villa Grimaldi, a secret torture site in Santiago. Bachelet and her mother survived and went into exile. Her return to Chile and eventual election as president on the socialist ticket has brought Chilean politics and history full circle. In October of 2006, she returned to Villa Grimaldi, and in November, Pinochet was placed under house arrest and charged with the kidnap and murder of prisoners there. This was not the first time that Pinochet was arrested. In 1998, while on a medicinal visit in London, he was put under house arrest after Spanish judge Baltasar Garzon issued a warrant for his arrest for the torture and murder of Spanish nationals. After 18 months, Britain finally allowed Pinochet to return to Chile for health reasons, avoiding extradition to Spain. Pinochet's death allowed him to escape conviction. Kissinger, whose support for the Pinochet regime is increasingly well documented, is still alive and still of interest to those seeking justice. Kissinger has been sought for questioning by Judge Garzon and by French Judge Roger Laloyer, both investigating the death and disappearance of their citizens in Chile. While Kissinger is frequently questioned by the media in this country, he's almost never asked about his own record. Instead, he's treated like royalty. Questions remain about the brutal regime of Pinochet. Kissinger likely holds many of those answers. If we are to have a uniform standard of justice, then answers need to be demanded of the genuine terrorism experts, such as Henry Kissinger. Now, I got a letter in here the other day, I gotta say, from a listener, and he kind of chastised me for using the term raghead. You know, boys and girls, I think this political correctness, you know, has gone to a point of absurdity. In the context that I use terms like raghead and peon, I would venture a guess and say that I have done more, said more in defense of Arabs, Muslims, Palestinians than my listener who wrote me the letter. And if I use colorful language, it is for the purpose of, in plain language, that every carpenter, plumber, and electrician can understand. Take a real look at international geopolitics. Now look at Henry Kissinger here in this context. This guy is the Secretary of State under the Nixon gang. Remember that? And he goes down here to Chile and supports an overthrow of a democratically elected government. Isn't that what we Americans are opposed to? Isn't that what we were opposed to when we said the communists over here are bad guys because they're supporting dictators in Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Poland? Isn't that the story? That they're supporting these communist puppet governments in Poland and Ukraine and so on? Well, hey, kids, isn't that what we Americans are doing over in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Chile in 1970? Overthrowing and then supporting after we've created these puppet governments? And then we run around calling the kettle black? That's why I couldn't contain myself when that Jap is criticizing us for bombing Nagasaki. Now, it's all right for us to criticize ourselves, but it sure as hell isn't proper for the Japanese to point their fingers at us. I mean, after all, we were at war, you know. And, you know, that's where we're at today in Iraq. You know, we're at war. I mean, this is a pretty serious war. We're in a battle now for our lives. I told you that yesterday. This is called the Second Battle of Baghdad. The first battle of Baghdad, we won that one hands down. Now we're involved in the Second Battle of Baghdad, but we're being reported to on a daily basis. Five Americans were killed today. Three Americans were killed today. Our news media keeps hammering us with these three or four people killed every day, as if Americans, five Americans getting killed every day is really bad, but 100 Iraqis getting killed is just a bunch of ragheads that don't count. And I say 100 Iraqis do count, whether I call them ragheads or not. And by the way, what do they got on their heads? Aren't those rags they got up there? Now, those are the same people, remember, that call us Satan and call us everything but white people. I mean, they call me a honky, a howly, a Satan. Hell, I'm doing them a favor when I call them a raghead. I'm being a nice guy. And furthermore, I'm championing their cause. I'm championing their cause because it's right. And that's the difference. So don't send me another letter and tell me that I'm being racist or that I'm being partial. Now, I gave you some facts here today about the Palestinians and about apartheid and the Israelis. I'm not taking sides one way or the other. I'm just a reporter reporting the facts. And I'm reporting facts that Katie and Brian don't tell you about, and U.S. News doesn't tell you about, and USA Today doesn't cover. All right, with that then, I'm going to wrap it up by reminding you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.